SoFi, the all-in-one super app for banking, borrowing, and investing. Earn industry-leading APY, get great loan rates, and trade stocks. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC.
Welcome to Market Call. That was a great Guy Adami. He's not here today, but we have a very special guest on the Market Call to my right. That would be Danny Moses. You know him. He is the co-host of the On the Tape podcast with Guy myself. But if it's Wednesday, it's EY from SoFi. We're going to get all your money right all in one live streaming web show today. How's that? Not good? That's not what you want to do with that?
Marketing.
Okay, no. Fair enough. We'll leave that stuff to your CMO over there, the very fine Lauren Stafford Webb, who I saw LSW. This past weekend. Yeah. That is actually a pretty good tagline for a company. Get your money. Financial services company. All in one app, right?
And absolutely. They are app-based, Danny.
Oh, so Danny's here. He's back in town. We have a big week on the Risk Reversal Media platform. Liz was on the tape podcast with me on Monday. Mm-hmm. We have Cameron Dawson tomorrow. That's going to be really interesting. She rocks. And then Carter Braxton-Worth and Danny are going to be with me on Market Call tomorrow. So check that out, 1 p.m. Eastern. You know what to do. You know, guys, let's just talk broad markets here for a second. It's kind of interesting how within just a couple weeks, you know, we get into Q2 and it seems like the tone of the market has really changed a lot, you know, and obviously it has a lot to do with yields. Liz, we're going to preview your note that drops on the SoFi investing blog tomorrow. You're going to spend some time on higher for longer. Let's just kind of throw up a rundown here, people, and run through what we're going to talk about. Please put your questions in to the whatever chat box it is, and Amanda is going to work through those. We're going to take them at the end of the look at that. Look at what Jacob just did there. We're going to work through that. But we got to talk about this chip wreck, what's going on in the semi space. Obviously, they've been huge, huge leaders in the broad market for many, many months. And if that were to start to abate a little bit, what that means for broader tech and the markets, obviously, we're going to hit Liz's note. And then Danny's here. We got to talk about housing. And you just brought this to my attention. I know our good friend Peter Bookvar was writing about it in the book report this morning about J.B. Hunt. So this is a trucker. And so these are really like kind of things that you want to keep your eye on just to see if the economy is starting to weak, if the long and variable lags are starting to work their way into the economy. So Liz, talk to me about what you feel has changed in the stock market, at least in the last month or so.
I mean, I don't even think it has been a month where it's changed. I mentioned this on the pod on Monday. I think there was a threshold between 440 and 450 on the 10-year where things changed. The market got tired of this higher for longer narrative, stopped digesting it in a clean way, and then correlations shifted. I've been talking about relationship problems for a long time where the variables aren't working in the same ways that they normally do.
That was really subtle. Are we having problems here, Liz?
No, I mean, I just want to be like,
do you see that?
Not personal. I mean, like, it's not okay, fine. That means it's a phrase.
Got you. For you listeners out there, she's doing air quotes there, people. Yeah. Okay.
So I've been talking about relationship problems because the variables aren't working the way that they normally would. But in April, they are working the way that they normally would. Yields go up, stocks go down. We're having this right sizing of PEs. We've got VIX up, stocks down. That's how it should work. Yeah. So far, I think we're in an environment where maybe we're normalizing and it's getting less irrational. Well, it doesn't mean yet that it's a big thing.
Yeah. And Danny, just to be clear, as things felt a little irrational on the upside in stocks, this was in March, it was like the narrative was like the market is broadening out. It's okay. If stocks are going up with yields going up, that means because the economy's better and it should be good for earnings. But that's not exactly what we're seeing so far this early this Q1 earnings period.
You're like caught in a period of time now where the sentiment about what the Fed is going to be doing is negative in the sense of higher for longer. So with that as a backdrop, everything tends to be, you need to be priced to perfection. And so if you miss, if you guide down, if there's any hiccup at all, you're going to get overly punished. People have been hiding in the secular growth stories now for a while, and they have an excuse to keep owning them because the Fed has your back, the Fed has your back. All this Fed dovishness previously, we think potentially moved commodity prices higher and self-fulfilled stickier inflation. And so they're somewhat trapped here. And I think we're just, again, I think you can trade stocks, like I said, on big down days, take advantage and buy quality names, and on big up days, sell things, you know. But when you see 10% moves, 20% moves in names, like I know we're going to talk about the chip sector and the chip wreck on names, no one was questioning valuation. It's all momentum. But when momentum gets broken, my biggest takeaway is
nobody was questioning momentum.
What is
justifying?
What is the buying value? What is the buy spot when momentum ends? It's not, you know, 40 times earnings. It's
And what do you need for momentum to keep going? What do you need for multiple expansion? You need lower rates. You need the availability of capital and that free flowing aspect that we lost.
Well, you don't in the big secular stories. I mean, like, let's be clear on this. So like a Microsoft and NVIDIA and a handful of other stories that are meant to be the huge beneficiaries of generative AI for years to come. Like that was what the positive narrative. They don't care. They have so much cash and they're running away with it because if you need to train these models and build these servers and go into these data centers and you need tens of billions of dollars, well, if you're Amazon, if you're Apple, if you're Microsoft, you know what I mean? Like you have that. Like, so where I think rates matter is if you are in the private markets and you need to raise capital to compete with the big platform companies, or if you're a small cap company, right? Like those things matter. And so that's what I think got really divorced in Q1 as the stock market was up 10% at one point from reality, because those multiples kept on expanding despite, you know what I mean? The fact that if there's no clear path to commercialization anytime soon, and the economy does start to slow, at some point you're starting to see job cuts, you know what I mean? That the all those companies that are hoping to sell those products, whether they be like licensing to seats, whether you're Microsoft or something like that, if you start seeing headcount go down, you know what I mean? You're gonna see enterprise spending go down. And ultimately that will be the thing. If you see weak Q2 guidance or for the balance of this year from some of these big platform companies that have been the big beneficiaries of Gen AI, that's how the whole market comes undone to me. Does that make some sense a little bit?
Yes. Don't let facts get in the way of a good story. Okay. What do I mean? We know that in the case of NVIDIA, just to bring up as an example, that 77% margins are not sustainable in a hardware. It's just not. It's just not. Can it go on for 2, 4, 5 quarters? Sure, maybe. But in the middle of all of this, during this hype up period, and maybe we're still in it to a degree, you have competition coming. You know that Intel's coming with their own. You know that Amazon said they're, we know that at some point this demand will normalize to a degree. And it's amazing to me how the sentiment shift all of a sudden, when sentiment shifts, then you care about those things. And if sentiment shifts enough and you care about things that are true drivers of fundamentals, that's the part where you get a reset. That's the part where I think you get a correction in some of these names. Yeah.
Well, and the theme will change. I mean, what you're talking about is a little bit more short term than what I'm about to say, but the theme is going to evolve over time. So not only does competition come in, but there's going to be new opportunities. Companies are going to either be created or go into different parts of the market because AI, just as a theme, changes. We find new ways to make money off of it. We find new ways to be productive or efficient off of it, the same way that the internet morphed over 10 to 15 years. And that will continue to happen over the course of, I think, the next 5 to 10 years. And we'll find out what that looks like then. But right now, everybody's pulling all of that forward as if the opportunity is already known, and as if we know how we're going to make profit on it from now until eternity. And that's just not the case.
Dan makes a great point about enterprise, because you think about just normal cycle of enterprise spending. Let's keep in mind that we are not in a recession. We're not even really close to it yet. You know, when you look at numbers, and that's great. But imagine actually in an actual downturn, these companies have already been downsizing a lot of these large tech companies in anticipation. They're much leaner. They're much more efficient. So you're always going to have that. But imagine what a real downturn looks like. And I know we're going to talk about some of these other names, but cyclically speaking, we are seeing a big bifurcation in the haves and have-nots.
Tesla is the best example. We haven't even had a recession yet. Okay. Now, rates, you could make the argument, are hurting them. They had expensive EVs that people don't exactly want. And to, you know, to finance those, when yields had this big spike, it got harder and harder. Elon's been whining about that for a year and a half or so. You know, it's making new 52-week lows today. Look at that. I mean, it's down from 300. It's basically down 50% from its highs a little less than a year ago. But again, we've not even had the economic, you know, kind of thing that you would think that would cause an auto company to have a tough time. It's just that they literally overbuilt, right, for something that people don't want anymore, and they're saturated, the competition's come in. So that's a whole separate story. Let's look at semis really quickly here, because you know, you wake up this morning, you see a headline that ASML is you know, reported you know, really bad quarter, and the guidance, you know, they try to be optimistic, they try to say they're going to kind of, you know, make some of this back in the quarter or two to come, primarily from Taiwan Semi. We know that Taiwan Semi just had a bang up quarter not too long ago, so there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there. But ARM, this was a semiconductor company that just came out again. They were private and SoftBank owned them, and they gave, you know, they put out a bit of this. It became a bit of a meme stock a few months ago, if you remember that sort of thing, or just got caught up in the enthusiasm as they changed their narrative around generative AI. That stock's down 10% with ASML in sympathy today. That's, I think, Danny, what you're starting to talk about here is that a lot of these stuff correlations are going to go higher. I want to highlight AMD. This is a company that, again, has not had the products. They're, I think, thought to have been in a better space than Intel to compete on the high-end GPUs with NVIDIA. Look at that thing. Look at how far that has come. About 30% from those March 8th highs. Guy was talking about the reversal an awful lot. Look at the breakout level. Look at where the 200-day moving average is. So there's an air pocket down, you know what I mean, to those sorts of levels. Mm-hmm. I think that's coming to a theater near you. When we saw Q4 earnings in late January, the stock was trading, you know, not particularly well, had that huge run, got caught up in the euphoria. And then I'll just kind of mention NVIDIA really quickly, because this is the one, this is the big kahuna, but they don't report until late May.
Right. Yeah.
You see that 50-day moving average up there. You see how far away it is, that rising 200-day. That was the breakout level from January, and it doubled. It gained $1 trillion in market cap. So Liz, talk to me about this one sector in particular, because we'll just throw up the SMH as you're talking about it a little bit from a sector standpoint. I mean, this is the one, you know, and you look at that, and you know, I think NVIDIA is 25% or so of that ETF. So that's a way, if you want to play NVIDIA without the idiosyncratic nature of it, that's probably one way to do it.
Yeah, I want to play devil's advocate on the chip wreck comment, just because if I simplify this, a lot of those individual names, even the charts that look really dramatic, maybe went up on momentum, coming back down on fundamentals.
Yeah.
If they went up on momentum, naturally they overshoot. We all know that was euphoric. It wasn't really based on enough data to drive stocks up that far that fast. So if they're coming back down on fundamentals, or maybe just a reality check, is that really a bad thing? Or is that something that brings them back into a more rational environment, a more rational trading range that says there's still opportunity in this asset class, there's still opportunity in the fundamental side of it, we just way overshot on the upside.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I mean, I think, you know, you're taking some of the froth, you're taking some turns off the multiple, you know what I mean? That they, and then, and really doesn't, Danny says this all the time, I mean, like, know what you own, do the work on individual names, there's going to be dispersion, you know, and we've seen that, right? So, you know, rising tides didn't lift the Intel boat, you know what I mean? Right. It did lift the AMD boat, but when the rubber hits the road, when they report and guide, you know, if they can't, you know, I think investors are getting in front. And I just want to make one point about NVIDIA. And I made this point probably, you know, 50 times over the last 2 months. I mean, the stock at one point this year was up 90% or a little bit more. Expectations for earnings and sales are expected to be 85, 90% respectively for this year. So you'd say that is in the stock. So if the company can't guide up, and they don't beat, okay, if you're looking at the expected deceleration next year in fiscal year 2026, it's 20%, okay? So my point is you're already pricing in what the expectation is for growth this year, followed by a massive deceleration, not incorporating anything what you just said, Danny, about the expectation that there is going to be a lot of competition, there might be some secular waves, there might be lower enterprise spending, there might be something that we don't see that happens here. So talk to me a little bit about that, maybe just on a single stock basis, because this is the one that encapsulates so much enthusiasm about this whole secular trend.
So no one asks questions when a stock's going up. It's just questions are coming out when it's down. Right, exactly. So I think I talk about this more on the tape. Obviously, I'm not really on here a lot, a market call, but I think it's important to understand that if you have a market cap like NVIDIA has, right, we talked about portfolio managers, basically hands get forced to chase. Once it becomes so big in an industry, they have to chase. What happened was, obviously, that's self-fulfilled and it's gone here and they have exposure. All the other semi names were kind of lagging for a period of time. There was a large, there was a long time where like, that's not doing anything.
Well, no, here's a good example. Micron didn't join the party until just recently.
So my point is that dog tail wagging, however you want to look at it, they kind of spun out. Now I would say that NVIDIA is still at the heart of all of this growth, right? They're in the right place, right time. Great for them. But everyone says, wow. So then think as a portfolio manager, okay, I missed this NVIDIA a little bit. I did catch up. I'm not missing this one. So I think these other ones that may not have as big of a growth story, right? It's really dependent on NVIDIA's sales and so forth, have kind of caught up. Now, they're not as expensive, some of them, but that's the problem again. So is it unwind? As I ask again, what is the buy point for these names as momentum? And that's all I'm saying. There will be buy points, and maybe they don't sell off that much. Maybe people buy the weakness here. But I just think that that's kind of what you're dealing with. It's a mo trade, as you know, as we call it.
Well, let's pull up IGV. Let's pull up software. And I know, Liz, you like to look at some of the sectors like within tech. And I think this is kind of an interesting one here, too, because, again, you know, Microsoft is a huge component of this ETF, right? And when you think about, you know, just, again, a lot of the enthusiasm, at least, you know, in the software sort of space, you know, given their relationship with OpenAI and the massive, you know, investment and their hopes of integrating that technology in their Copilot and across all their productivity suite, that thing's rolling over. I mean, just, you know, look at that here. So thoughts, you know, as you drill down on some of the subsectors within tech, you know what I mean? Like software is important because Microsoft, if it's the largest component of this ETF, it's nearly 10% or so. It's seen massive multiple expansion on the hope that they're able to basically get higher margins, you know, better commercialization of these sorts of products across their, you know, productivity suite.
Yeah. Well, so the reason I look at some of these industry groups within tech, if you take software versus semis, what I'm trying to do with that usually is figure out if there's a signal in it, similarly to when you take like discretionary versus staples, right? You can dig down into the sectors and find out. So if you take software versus semis, typically, if semis are outperforming software over a period of time, it's a pro-cyclical signal. You've got semiconductors as a much more cyclical component. Software typically is a little bit longer sales lead, a little bit stickier revenue. If you look at the trailing one-month period, software has still underperformed semis. However, the recent correction has been much, much steeper in semis than it has been in software. So that would tell me recently, and this is literally just a few days, but recently, the cyclicality argument has fallen off, right? Just the enthusiasm over the fact that why industrials have rallied so much, why transports did so well before, that argument and that optimism is falling off, which would honestly tell me that in an environment like this, if these things continue to correct and you want to put money to work in tech, I'd buy software, not semis.
Yeah. And this goes back to, you know, the point, Danny, that I was just kind of making is like, okay, if you, you know, need the GPUs, that's fine. You're one of these hyperscalers and you want to have these, you know, foundation models on your, you know, public cloud. So, you know, startups and anybody, you know, any sort of business, you know what I mean? Like that's how they're going to basically rent that access to that technology. But at some point, you know what I mean? Like these companies, if they can't demonstrate how all of that investment is turning into sales and in a higher margin sales, you're going to see things slow down a little bit. And if we do have a slower economy, ultimately you're going to see slower enterprise spending, and that's all going to be, you know, wrapped up into one sort of thing. And I think we spend so much time talking about, and we're going to do this in a few minutes, higher for longer, what it means for the consumer, you know what I mean? But enterprise is probably more important right now.
Yeah, for sure. I think SaaS is much cooler and a higher multiple than GPU. But when you put GPU with AI, you kind of get it. And when you put software with AI, but you're right. I think from a recurring revenue perspective, software is just a more stable business over time from an enterprise perspective. And I think, again, to bring point, if Microsoft has a massive drawdown, people are going to be willing to buy that because it's consistent earnings and it's a great company. You know, it's tested many, many cycles and so forth. So I'm looking at the components of the IGV you have here. And it's just, it's nonsense in the sense of, you would never buy that.
Yeah.
You would pick out the names. They're all so different. I mean, look at the top 10 names are very, very different from each other. And so, again, stock picking.
Well, here's a good example. All right. So Microsoft is the name because of that $13, $14 billion they've invested in OpenAI and that type relationship. So that's clearly been a beneficiary. Salesforce has a, you know, a generative AI product, and they're going to be integrating that into a lot of their CRM sorts of things. Oracle is trying to tell that story. Adobe, maybe they can pull up a live chart of Adobe. This is one we've talked about a bunch. It is not join the party, man. And this is a stock that never got back to its all-time highs from 2021. I think it was about 15 or 20% or so above that when it was just trading recently at its 52-week highs, if they could pull up ADBE here. And so that one to me is really interesting. They spent a lot of time in 2023 talking about generative AI, and it's not participating here whatsoever. So some of the other names in there are security and the like here. So again, some of these, you know, some of these ETFs don't always do the thing that you want them to do, but they might give you a broad swath of that because the security names are in there. They're talking about generative AI. Look at that gap through the 200-day. I mean, some of these stocks are telling you that there's very few names that are going to be the beneficiaries near term. All right, before we get to yields and before we get to the preview of your note, this is Doug Kass sent this over from Seabreeze, and I thought this was a really interesting chart. So he's talking about corporate buybacks and net selling from corporate executives, C-level suite. So Danny, if you see this, this seems like right up your alley a little bit, right? So companies are still buying back their stock, but if you look at this relationship, okay, so the net of the two, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's Doug's saying this is the most bearish it's been in 10 years or so. So it tells you that the companies are still buying their stock, but the executives are selling.
Well, I think they'll get questions if they don't buy back their stock from time to time, right? So and again, without the ability to leverage like we used to have when rates were at zero, I think people forget that created so many buybacks because you could take out debt literally 1 or 2% and buy back your stock. And so I'm sure it's just, you know, Dan, you know, tax and estate planning for these, executives
and
they're being sold at 10b5-1. So,
you know what I mean?
They're like, how expensive are braces these days?
They're like set sales and I have nothing to do with those sales and it's every month and 10b5-1 plans. But no, certainly it's a great stat to look at and pay attention to. And a lot more sells on the insider than buys these days, for sure.
All right, let's do a little relationship management here. Let's talk about what you're looking at. Again, if it's Wednesday, Liz is here, and she does a preview of her note that drops on the SoFi. But where can we get that, Liz? Where does that? Look at that.
You know what? You can go to a lot of different places. It'll just pop up if you go to the home feed on our app. You can go to the website, find it on the blog.
Is that Othello or tic-tac-toe? What is that exactly?
Maybe a blend of both.
Okay. Yeah. I have to do the guy parties.
I
loved here.
Othello. Remember Othello?
You flip black or white, you flip the thing. Anyway, sorry,
nerds.
Sorry. Please continue.
Anyway, this week's blog is called Worth the Wait? It's talking about the Fed. We've been waiting for cuts. We continue to wait longer for cuts. Here's what Mario and I did in this week's note. We projected some scenarios because that seemed like fun. Mm-hmm. So if you look at that dotted line in the middle, the dark purple one,
that's basically a dot plot.
It does, I know. And when we hemmed and hawed a lot on how to display this chart, so that dotted purple line in the middle is the current pricing of the Fed funds rate path, okay? So the market right now is assuming that we are going to start later, obviously, but we're going to do it in a very slow and methodical way because the Fed wants to, not because the Fed has to. So we started to think, what if that changes? Because we know that the Fed is very bad at predicting their own rate path. So I think we take the most important one to look at is what if they go even slower and even later, which would raise yields even further. So if you look at that magenta dot line on the top, that would be if they wait even longer to start cutting and then go even slower, because inflation obviously would stay stickier. The economy is still strong enough to withstand it, or that would be the narrative. So then we project with Mario's math skills what the 2-year yield might look like if they waited longer to cut and if they went slower. The 2-year yield would go up to, let's call it 5.25 as round numbers, okay? So where we are today, we're about 4.9 today. It would go up to 5.25. Does that matter? Why does that matter? I think it does matter a lot. And first of all, it would keep the yield curve inverted. There are good things and bad things about a higher 2-year yield or a yield that stays higher for longer. The good thing is, if you're in money market funds, you're still getting a great yield. If you have short-term treasuries, you're still getting a great coupon. And if you're in some kind of interest-bearing account, still going well for you. If you are a bank that has to pay interest on that account, if you are somebody that's trying to take out short-term capital, or if you're the federal government who's trying to continue borrowing and issuing treasuries, this is a problem. And I think, like we talked about earlier in the show, we hit a pivot point between 4.4 and 4.5 on the 10-year where investors stopped liking higher rates and they became untenable. So I think what's going to happen here, if we do see the 2-year continue to rise, is that it'll become more and more of a problem for markets. And you see this correlation, that's a negative correlation between stocks and yields stay intact. One more thing about this piece, even if we just simply assume that the 10-year yield goes up by the same amount, so let's assume a parallel shift in the yield curve up, in this case, then you've got a 10-year that's about 4.9 from here. The last time the 10-year was at 4.9, the S&P was 16% below where it is today.
Yeah.
So that wasn't that long ago.
That was like late October.
Right.
Danny, what can you see a scenario right now, given, you know, the Fed speak, and there's been a lot of it this week or so, where the 10-year yield is not going to go back and test those October highs at 5%?
I do believe that we will have, we've seen a little bit of it in the last two out of the last five trading days, so to speak, where there's been a flight to quality, so to speak. Call it quality
well,
for
let's
now.
Pull
if you
the
want,
chart
10
up
year yields, okay? Yeah, how quality that is. You know, if you really
traditionally,
The U.S. government balance sheet as a company, I think yields would obviously be much higher. But you've had a couple of days. So can it get to 5%? Sure. If it gets there, why is it there? Is it there because failed auction or we announced quarterly refundings and we announced issuance going forward? It's going to be much higher. What's the reason? To me, it's about the reason. Mm-hmm. I would actually think that a stronger economy and a healthier stock market will come with a gradually raising yield. Rising yield. What do I mean by that? It means we've now been 2 years into this thing, and there is a lag effect of certain, we're starting to see it in certain industries and certain things, but we can survive. Certain companies can survive in it. People forget our normalized 10-year yields are right here. Mm-hmm. 5-6%. Look back, mm-hmm. bring up the long term of the 10-year yields. Like, we're just getting back to quote normal. So I guess I go back and forth with every time the Fed gets more hawkish, right? Mm-hmm. I can understand why 10-year yields I think would come in, mm-hmm. not rise, because you're gonna accentuate the slowdown or force the slowdown even more. So I kind of grapple with it, because I'll say this, I really don't want to have to deal with why if yields are going up because of supply and demand. That's a totally different conversation in terms of what's right. So I guess I grab, of course it can go there. To 5%.
All right. So Liz, let's talk about dollar strength, which is coming with higher yields here, because this is something that, again, you know, I've been saying this for a bit. It's like, so if we have higher yields, we know that that's going to hit, you know, small caps a bit harder. We've been talking about that a little bit, but the dollar for multinationals, you know what I mean? Not a great do. Commodity prices rising again, you know what I mean? Or having a resurgence a little bit. All those things should weigh on corporate margins, right? So if S&P earnings start to come down because margins are compressing a little bit because inflationary fears, stronger dollar, all that sort of stuff, then you have a situation where the S&P, you just said the last time the 10-year yield was at 4.9%, the S&P was at like 4,400, you know, it was on its way to 4,100 or something like that, 4,200 or something. So at some point, something's got to give, like, right? There needs to be a valuation reset.
Right. Well, and the reason we wanted to focus on the dollar is because I think there's sort of this prevailing attitude right now that a stronger dollar is good, uncategorically good. Mm-hmm. And that is the case in some regards. And if you're comparing us to Japan and saying a stronger dollar is good because our purchasing power is better, yes, that's true. But there are things about it, if you look at the way that the market reacts, if we can pull up the second chart from the column. So if yields are rising, in same scenario, if we know what's happening right now in the market, if the Fed goes slower and if they go later, yields go up more, especially in the 2-year, the dollar you would expect to follow suit and continue strengthening. First of all, what's really interesting, the way that we're defining a strong dollar environment and a weak dollar environment, this is going to get wonky and mathematical, but one standard deviation away from where it's been trading. Okay, that's a simple explanation. We're not even in strong yet, mm-hmm. because it's been pretty strong for a while, but we're close. So it's trading, the Dixie's trading about 106 today. It would have to go to 108. To enter what we would categorize as a strong dollar environment here. This is sector performance in a strong dollar environment in the blue bars, weak dollar environment in the red bars. And then we sorted them by what happens in a strong dollar. So if we assume that we enter that environment, yields are rising, dollar is rising, we enter strong dollar, look at those sectors that perform the best. Staples, healthcare, utilities. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely straightforward defensive sectors. So if you're operating under the assumption that strong dollar is good, these sectors would not be the ones that would outperform. So what does that mean? Historically, a strong dollar happens more than one standard deviation away from normal. A strong dollar happens because the world is scared. We don't want to enter, I would argue, an extreme strong dollar environment, because that probably means that other things have broken down. Mm-hmm. People are buying it because other things have gone wrong. So we're sort of on this precipice of, we think everything is good, yields up is not great anymore, but we still have a strong dollar, we still have a strong economy. And this is a relationship problem too, that I think is about to flip.
Isn't it a big deal though? It's just more, it's all relative, right? So mm-hmm. ECB is going to be cutting rates in June. That we know, it's probably going to happen. Mm-hmm. BOJ is going nuts right now because they need to come in and intervene because their currency is getting weak. So mm-hmm. we could have a situation where the dollar is strengthening, where our economy is weakening, mm-hmm. but it's still stronger than everything else. That case scenario, I don't know how anything plays out with that chart. What I'm saying is it's all relative. Dollars mm-hmm. is a relative trade on everything else. So we know China, we know Japan, we know the ECB, we know what's happening. So that to me is the real problem. And if you have the dollar blowout on slowing economy, then what do you do?
It's interesting to see these sectors and again, but I think to your point, Danny, is like if we have a Dixie making new 52-week highs on its way to 110, if we have the 10-year yield going through the prior highs at 5%, right? We have oil, let's say, back at $90, is trading at $83. We're going to look at that really quickly here. At that point, it's not going to matter. Correlations are going to go to one. Yep. You know what I'm saying? And we will be literally, and Carter said this yesterday at Market Call, you know, we're almost at a 5% drawdown from the highs, the recent highs. Once you get greater than a 5% drawdown, things usually start to accelerate a little bit. You think back to late July to late October, what is it, about 11% or so in the S&P 500, but a lot of the market leaders actually performed far worse than the market did. So, you know, we'll keep a close eye on all that. Before we get to a single name here that's reporting tomorrow morning, let's just look at crude oil really quickly here, because again, you know, heading into last weekend, there was a lot of fears of what might go on between Israel and Iran. And, you know, you saw that move, 86 and a half or so. Here we are at 83. And I didn't draw those lines so well. But, you know, you see that uptrend that's kind of been in place. It's pretty easy to see with your eyes. Let's see if we hold here at 83. Danny, thoughts on oil? Because if the global economy is not as strong as the U.S. economy, and if the U.S. economy is maybe going to start to feel the lags of, hawkish sort of, or newfound hawkish stance by the Fed or so, you know, you got to say to yourself, you know, is there a bid for crude if there's no geopolitical sort of issues here?
But there is a geopolitical. You're right. There are massive. So it's really hard to discern, but, you know, between the two. I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I would rather just take that chart and say, do I want to own the stocks themselves? And as I've said before, I think
pull up the XLE for a second here. Yeah. So large integrateds, I mean, that's one that you and Guy have been kind of pounding the table on. You know, it's performed really well until very recently. And you say to yourself, okay, just look at where it pulled back to, those prior highs that it broke out from. So if you can make a constructive case for these, then then you're nearing a point. I'd almost wait until it gets back to that 200-day and see if it holds down there. But, you know, who knows?
Sure. I mean, Liz just highlighted, energy was not one of the three you would want to own in a defensive nature. So where's this money going? It's going into healthcare and staples and so forth, for sure. There's an excuse to do that, because at some point oil goes so high that it obviously is having a detrimental effect on the U.S. consumer, and you have to start to incorporate those things. And we're already seeing signs of that. But the flip side of that, if oil does drop, Dan, that inflation, people would say, oh, that gives the Fed more cover to cut sooner, because they know it's good. So there are a lot of one-offs to that.
I tweeted early in this, sorry guys, but if you can find the tweet, I'll talk slowly to let you have time. I tweeted just as I was walking here about the SPR and the level of oil prices right now, and just some speculation about what might happen if they continue to rise. And also something that I've been thinking about, has the utility of the SPR changed, right? And this is probably opening a can of worms on the political side, but is it there now to control volatility in oil prices, or is it there to protect us from a shortage in oil? We are now a net oil exporter. So this is the tweet. This is basically just showing us where the Biden administration started releasing from the SPR. Mm-hmm. That's that vertical line.
Late
and then where they,
right?
22
okay.
after Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah.
When we had that spike
in
oil prices.
They started talking about it in November, December, and then
right, but then it began. Yeah, and then they stopped. They stopped releasing in 23. They took the SPR from about 600 million barrels down to 325 million. So then that range down there is where they started to refill it, right? They took it back up to, I think we're at 365 today. Mm-hmm. And then we've had volatility in prices. At what point does a rise in oil prices start to bring back on the table releases from the SPR to control volatility? Yeah. And how do you factor that in to the equation, and what happens to
the old walk-in tweet? Liz was doing a walk-in tweet here. That's pretty dangerous, Liz, in this big city. You know, I'll just mention this. This story in the Journal, I think it was on Monday, caught my eye. Big oil companies warm to Biden after years of bad blood. So so it's interesting. You know, again, we've become this huge producer. You know what I mean?
Please approve our mergers.
Yeah, well, but that's one thing. I mean, like, you know, it seems, you know, that's probably an election year, not a bad place to be. All right. Let's we're going to take your questions. We got a lot of good ones here, but I just want to hit a couple things. Just J.B. Hunt. This is really interesting. You brought this to my attention, Danny. Okay, so this is a trucker. And again, you go drill in to see some of the reasons why.
Freight.
But new 52-week lows. And yesterday we talked about Johnson & Johnson. Not a small company, right? Like, there's some idiosyncratic stuff to J&J over there, but that was new 52-week lows. And we are 5% or so off the highs in the S&P 500. You know, we talked about stocks like Apple have been trading very poorly. That was a former market leader. Not far, people, from its 52-week lows. You know, Tesla is a $500 billion market cap company. 52-week lows. That's not the sort of divergence that you want to see if you're expecting this to be a shallow drawdown, Danny.
Yeah, if you go back, and if I can get a longer-term chart of that back to COVID, I don't know where that goes back to exactly, but what happened was, obviously, during the freight craze, shutdown, right? And all the supply chain stuff, right? Yep. This became a hot sector. And what you hit, a lot of capacity came online, right? So just things normalizing creates bad bids in the freight world. Like, what are you willing to pay to ship something? There's another part of this, though, which is their intermodal, which is really just the train cars that you see. You see those and move those around. That is economic to a degree. So you definitely have more of a supply glut than a demand fall off. At the same time, that's all it's based upon is kind of the spot prices and so forth. So if you believe that we're going to continue this soft landing scenario, things are okay, probably at some point things will fix themselves because you have bankruptcies of smaller players that aren't public like J.B. Hunt and so forth. But if not, if you think the economy has, you know, reached its high and it's probably not something you're going to want to buy on the dips right here. This company's been around a long time, but if you see it's kind of just normalizing from that time period that you've seen there. So
yeah, that's a good point. Well, and Guy talks about this all the time. You have to watch the transports as a cyclical signal, the same way that I watch construction employment as a cyclical signal. And I think you're right. It doesn't mean that the companies are broken. It's nothing like that, but it is very much a cyclical component. And if you remember, after COVID, we had shipping costs go through the roof, right? So much like inflation driving up the revenues of consumer staples companies, shipping costs drove up the revenues of a lot of these shipping companies. And not because they suddenly were fundamentally more healthy, not because there was suddenly that much more lasting demand. It was just that costs went up.
Well, here, pull up UNP really quickly. So this is Union Pacific. So you're talking about intermodal, you know, those are the ones moving around. Those, they come off of boats, they go to trains, they get on, trucks. Look at the move that this thing has had. Pull out a 1-year chart here. You know, like this was, you know, almost 260. And here we are right on that 200-day moving average. So from a technical standpoint, kind of interesting. CSX doesn't look too different. So, you know, when you start to piece this sort of stuff together, you know, that the IYT is fine and good. But like, let's look at one of these individual companies are saying, and if they kind of all kind of thread a needle a little bit, it's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's look real quickly before we get to the questions. DHI, that's D.R. Horton, Danny. Dr. Horton reports tomorrow morning before the open about a 5.5% implied move or five or so in either direction. It's about $7 here. You see those massive moves, right? So like off of the October lows, we know what happened. Six cuts started to get priced in for 2024. We know that the supply demand dynamics in the housing situation here in the US, we've gone sideways for the most part. I mean, we did make a new high, pretty precipitous drop from those recent highs. We're getting to some technical levels here. Thoughts on home builders? And we can pull up the ITB. This is the largest component of the ITB, which is the more home construction ETF.
As you know, I had Ivy Zelman on, who's the queen of housing, not too long ago. Probably time to bring her back on again to talk to her about this. These stocks historically can certainly trade under 1x book value. Yep. They've been rising towards 2x book value, right? There was a shortage for a long period of time of new homes, and there was a movement going on of people out of the cities into homes. And it's become an affordability issue because people aren't leaving their homes, obviously, at one point to buy something new, and also where rates are. Mm-hmm. And so I just think we're still in a range here, but certainly when you get over 1.6, 1.7x book for a builder that are cyclical companies, let's not mistake. Yes, there's been a secular aspect since COVID of people leaving the city, but this is a perfect example of a sector that people are probably hiding in because fundamentals were so strong that at some point has to turn from secular back to cyclical. We're seeing that around many things. And so they bought back, they had a buyback in place. I believe that the May high, if I'm not mistaken, was, or March, May, when Buffett announced that I think he had obviously bought some was the actual, I think it was this one. This one was the actual top on this thing. But in any event, these are cyclical companies and they can be bought and sell them on the extreme valuation, rich nor 2x book. And towards 1x book, if you still believe that things are okay.
The only way I could make a bull case for this is in my Twitter feed as well, is that if you look at some of the housing data, one of the things that's important to watch is the construction backlog, because it tells you a lot about, are we clearing that? How much is still on the docket coming down the pike? And the backlog has not cleared that much. So that means that there's still projects sitting out there waiting to be built. Of course, if the economy turns down, you'll see those projects get canceled pretty quickly. But at this point, if all things held equal, there's still a decent amount of backlog to keep some of those stocks elevated.
I'll give you one other.
Look how fast you guys are. Good, impressive.
Wow. I'll give you one other anecdote on this. And so I was with a friend of mine who's big in storage and multifamily in the Sunbelt states, right? Mm-hmm. He said, things are slowing dramatically. I go, what do you mean dramatically? He goes, there's no more movement. People aren't moving anymore, right? Which would explain a lot of things in transport and so forth, but storage names, right? So I don't want to bring those up here, but storage names and multifamily. So let's keep in mind, people, that leverage in the system is what always kills you, right? It's leverage in a product, leverage in a trade, whatever it might be. So when you think about some of these mom and pop developers, which became big again, like we saw in 2000, we saw this in 2004, 5, 6. It won't be as catastrophic as that. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But when rates move higher and the cap rates, right, can no longer satisfy your borrowing rates, you are forced to slow down. So we are seeing, and that will have a big impact on employment and construction materials, things that you guys talked about. So you're going to hear more and more of that. So keep your eyes and ears open.
All right, let's go to the questions here. We have one. This is from Ethan Gazikowski, and it's for Liz.
Oh,
hi, Liz. How much do you think the Fed focuses on mortgage rates and the effect to which they have on housing affordability and inflation? That's also right in Danny's wheelhouse, but let's start with Liz.
Well, yeah, Danny, you can answer after me. So I don't think that they focus directly on mortgage rates. I think they focus on the 10-year treasury, which is directly related to mortgage rates. So if you take the 10-year treasury yield and add about 300 basis points, that's usually where the mortgage rate, the 30-year mortgage rate sits. And I think that that matters to them because it's the functioning of capital markets. Housing affordability, interestingly, when they came out with talking about the super core, right, the super core PCE and the super core, that's core services ex shelter, they purposely tried to take shelter out of it. So the way that inflation measures shelter is kind of strange. It's not really the best representation of what people are actually paying for shelter. I do think the Fed has plenty of people trying to figure out what people are actually paying for shelter that isn't reflected in those official numbers. So I think it matters to them, but you're not going to hear it necessarily come out of their mouths as a measurable piece.
I will push back and I will say, and I'll look in the camera for this one, on May 1st, when we get news on quantitative tightening and the tapering, let's keep in mind that of the $95 billion a month that rolls, right, doesn't get reinvested, $35 billion of mortgage-backed securities. You look back to the exact moment when the Fed talked about ending QE, that's when mortgage spreads started widening. Period. End of story. I believe they will actually potentially, and they don't mention mortgages as much as they do treasuries. But I think they're going to specifically mention, just keep in mind,
mortgages.
We're going to pull back on those two potentially in terms of QT. So I do think there's a shot that we get some type, because again, now for the first time, literally between these two meetings is when it's really becoming more evident that we are seeing a slowdown in the housing.
Well, so you've got some experience in mortgage-backed security
market, right? Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Something about your history tells me that. So, but how does that feed through? I'm asking that just as much for myself as our listeners. How does, if the Fed comes out and says, okay, we're going to keep engaging in QT, we want to reduce just the mortgages held on our balance sheet, we're going to keep the balance sheet the same, but we want more treasuries, less mortgages. How does that feed through to the consumer mortgage rates? Why does that matter?
Want less mortgages, meaning that they're basically going to keep tightening on the mortgage side and not on the
What if they start to imply that they might engage in outright sales?
Well, that would not go well. I mean, I don't see that happening. I think they're going to do the opposite. So, but the answer would be Wall Street's always going to be ahead of this trade. So watch the spreads prior to that meeting. They're already going to know obviously what that's going to be, but I don't think that that would do well for the markets here.
All right, here's one. It's kind of related. This is from Casey 9. If you put those threes together, you get the 9. I see what you did there, Casey. Do you expect the long end of the curve to come in as people might be seeking the traditional safe harbor of U.S. bonds? Now, Danny, you just kind of alluded to that
Casey, a
little bit. Do it in your Casey Kasem voice. So go ahead.
This long distance dedication comes from KC339. Keep your feet in the ground and keep reaching for the stars. Sorry. So, yes, I believe that could happen. I believe that's the best outcome that you can have. Like I said, let that be a normal cycle of a treasury rally. And believe me, Yellen will be out there if that happens, just dumping treasuries onto the market. Can it happen? I don't know, but it's going to zigzag to get there if it does get there.
I think I do also think that at some point it comes down. I think it goes up a little bit first, and that's what breaks it in order to drive it back down. And I do think that there's, and I know we've been saying this for a long time, but we're at this point right now where currency volatility is rising around the globe. Monetary policy is diverging around the globe. Yields are going to continue to be volatile. At some point, we just can't stomach that anymore. And I think there's going to be something, whether it's Japan, right, freaking out because their currency devalued so much, they have to dump a bunch of treasuries, it drives yields up, and that's what breaks something. But I do think that they'll rise a little bit more first. then fall.
Yeah. All right. Here's one from Ari Srimi. And this is kind of all related to, if the 10-year manages to get to 5%, where does that take the 2-year and the 5-year? And where is the S&P? I'll let you guys opine on where the 2 and the 5 are. Mm-hmm. I would just say with the S&P 500, if we looked at the move, let's pull up an S&P chart really quickly here, a 1 year. If you just look at that move from 4,600 down to 4,150 from late July, okay, to late October, that was about 11.5% or so, I think. And if I look at where we just topped out, you know, above 5,200 or so, that was about 11% peak to trough decline. If we were to go all the way back to that 200-day moving average, you know, just above, you know, maybe just below 4,700 or so, that would be about 11%. And that would make a lot of sense to me. And Peter Buchvar mentioned this to us. He was on Market Call with me on Monday, but he had been mentioning it in his note that back in the highs in July of 2023, we were about 12 or so percent above its 200-day moving average. And if almost every year on record has at least a 10% peak-to-trough drawdown in the S&P 500, 4,650, 4,600 makes some sense to me. Thoughts on that, Danny? And again, you know, I'll just be very clear. If we were to get down there on a sort of orderly sell-off, okay, because multiples are coming in, some of the expectations for some of these big secular trades have kind of, okay, we pulled that forward, that sort of thing. That's probably not a bad level to kind of get a bit more aggressive, especially if you were a dollar cost averager of the markets in general, to me, because I'm not expecting any sort of calamity. I just think we should take some euphoria out of the market. I think we should have a VIX that's going from 20 to 30 and putting some fear back in folks and trying to reassess where they think these secular stories should trade on evaluation.
Yeah, basis. I think he's describing a bear steepener. Which is not a good thing. Obviously, people don't believe it's a good thing.
Right.
But again, it's why did it get there? If the thought is that the Fed just went ahead and cut rates because they said, all right, we'll deal with 3% inflation, but the economy is really slowing, and people believe that that would take up longer term inflation expectations, you could get that type of movement. Is that good for the stock market? Maybe in a near term, but I think then the reality would set in that's not a positive.
Liz, you've been talking about bear steepening for a while here. Thoughts on what that means for the stock market?
Not good things.
Yeah. But again, when you say not good things, and I just want to be really clear on this, because a lot of folks, you know, I remember one of the early podcast on the tape in 2021, and we were, I think, a bit goofier back then.
Willy Wonka?
It was something like, we were taking quotes usually to name our podcast, and Danny had a quote one day, is like, I love calamity. Right. And ended up into the thing, and right. we had to kind of like tone that one down a little bit. And
I love opportunity.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, calamity presents opportunity.
Right.
And that's kind of my point in a way. I could see myself getting a lot more constructive on the stock market at 4,600 than I could right here. And you could say to yourself, why weren't you more constructive at 4,150 last late October? Well, we had gotten the reasons why we had gone down there, right? I don't think we were pressing the lows, you know what I mean, by any means. But so Liz, thoughts on that?
Yeah. So first of all, just so everybody knows what a bear steepener is, you've got long-term going up faster than short-term, which sounds like that's not what Danny's base case is. But if that were something that happened, actually, this is something that we didn't tweet, but we did the work on it earlier this week in bear steepening environments, the sectors that perform better. So usually it is good for cyclicals, but you have to think about why that might be. Why would long-term rates be going up? Because the economy is strong, right? So usually good for cyclicals, not good for defensives. But that also assumes that the economy is rising. This is my opinion. Mm-hmm. The economy is rising during a part of the cycle where we haven't gotten to a point that we've overheated yet. Mm-hmm. We still have room to grow. I think in this cycle, we have already overheated and we're running the risk of reheating to an overheating place with inflation still where it is. So a bear steepener right now, I think, would actually be an environment where inflation continues to heat back up and we've got a problem that we have to try to solve on the other side of it.
Stagflation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's something you've been talking about for a while. Let's go to this one. This is actually really interesting to me. This is from Jay. I believe it's Jay Sloan, who's here with us every day. Jay. Thanks, Jay.
My horse support. Man.
He's the man. He said, while Guy is out chasing Giants Causeway, can Danny or Dan opine on the TRV gap on earnings report? So I just want to pull up the traveler chart here, the TRV, and I'll let you talk about the fundamentals maybe, Danny, for a second here.
Okay.
Well, I mean, what's important to me about this chart right here is that that gap to new highs was on an earnings event, right? Mm. And then it kept on going. So then there were investors who were caught offsides or loved what they saw, and they bought it the day after that earnings. And then they kept on buying it, whether it was whatever the story might have been, okay? The fact that we've just basically reversed the entire move in a week that happened in 2.5 months or so after an earnings event, on an earnings event. Okay, so let's bookend this 3-month period or so. I think this is really important for a lot of folks as they head in with their most favorite stocks or stocks that maybe they're not paying any attention to, that have been on runaway breakouts. Like, this can happen. And so again, we highlighted a couple names that were making new 52-week lows after earnings. Here's one that's reversed a three-month move, Dan.
They did increase their dividend, though, okay, Dan, it appears. Enough. I'm all joking. Right, but I just want to say something to Jay Sloan. He'll appreciate this. I don't know if he's going to be up in Saratoga for the Belmont this year. I know he's a big.
I know they're doing the Belmont.
It's epic.
June.
I don't think people realize on a 1.25.
Open like in June?
No, it normally opens in July for the meet.
Yeah.
But I think this is going to be one of the coolest things to happen because you only get normally 5 or 6 horses in Belmont because it's a mile and a half.
Are you going up for that?
Yes, be up there. So Jay, if you're coming up, reach out to me. It's an epic
good for
event.
Saratoga to get a little.
It's 2 years. They have a 2-year run at this. Oh yeah. Okay. So anyway, combined ratio is the biggest thing that people look at. Yeah. Obviously, with these companies, it wasn't good. The catastrophes continue, right? And mm-hmm. they can raise premiums to a degree, but I think their business slowed. I haven't been able to look at this thing entirely, but again, it's in the. I guess it's in the XLF. I'm sure it's in there as a piece of that as well. And it's been run up with all the financials they ran up. That chart is probably very similar to J.P. Morgan mm-hmm. to a degree. I would imagine if you put the two side by side, the thing may have sold off obviously a little bit more. But again, know what you own. And I think the property casualty stocks are interesting. I think they're defensive to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, in a bad economy, what do people tend to do? They tend to claim more you know, insurance.
So, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway.
All right. Let's go to E&P here. Hi. Could you, Zscaler, I don't know. It's basically asking, could Zscaler Starbucks find a bottom? I don't know. That was written by ChatGPT maybe, but EMP, maybe you're just a chat bot. But we
hasn't seen an uptick since Red Cup Day, Starbucks, by the way.
Well, it's interesting. And you were talking about it at the time. And you know, this is one of those stories that I think, you know, it was trading a premium multiple. Maybe if the consumer's trading down, a lot of China exposure, at least for their growth, you know, strong dollar, commodity prices. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, this got a little bit of everything. Liz, talk to us about that consumer narrative. You don't have to tell us, you know, talk to us about Starbucks in particular, but like I hear Starbucks and I just threw all of those like data points out there and I don't even need to know the specifics, but that's been weighing on the sentiment of a stock like this.
Yeah. Well, so retail sales, we got retail sales recently and they were much stronger than expected. It shot yields up.
But decelerating like period over period, right? Like, wasn't there a big number in February? And while they're better than expected in March, they were like decelerated meaningfully.
They decelerated, yes, but what has mattered to the market more in most metrics lately mm-hmm. is that if it came in above expectations, it's a win, mm-hmm. even if it's different from, if it means something from last month. So retail sales still appear healthy month over month. I think the consumer narrative is intact on that front if we're looking at the data, but everybody also knows that the consumer is getting irritated and out of stamina with all of these price hikes. And mm-hmm. just as an anecdote, I went to a Starbucks. This was a couple weekends ago. I just want you to guess. I got a matcha latte.
Yeah.
How much? The smallest size.
$6.50.
More.
$9.
What?
Yeah.
What is the small size? I don't know the sizes. And I'm just going to speak for Guy. He goes into Starbucks all the time. So to get our guests, like he'll walk out of the NASDAQ and he'll go over the Starbucks and this and whatever.
He's
never
a lot
used
of money.
The term Vente or what are the other names that they have
tall,
there?
Tall, Grande, and Venti.
Yeah.
So tall is the small.
You can put a
grande
gun in my head.
Medium.
I couldn't tell you what they are.
Yeah. All right. But anyway, smallest one, $9. And it was because I changed the milk.
Did
to
you buy it on
milk.
A firm? Yeah, maybe they give you like some price.
No. Yeah, right. Buy now, pay later. Yeah. I pay for half of it now.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's ridiculous, right? Yeah. And that's if people have that habit of doing it every day. I'm normally just a black coffee drinker, which is cheaper. But still, if you're getting those, you know, that's going to start weighing on revenue.
Danny, why did Starbucks a few months ago catch your eye? Again, this was a raging bull market.
It was the union. Yeah, they're trying to unionize in certain places. It happened in upstate New York. They've been talking about
that. That's another one. So throw higher wages in there.
No, that is. They've been paying higher wages. And they're trying to come to terms.
But it's commodity prices. It's wages.
It was trying to slow down.
All those sorts of things. Really quickly, we had two questions. questions about Zscaler. There was somebody else. I just want to throw this one out. This is from ENP. Well, were we just talking about ENP? Maybe you had two questions. Oh, Ian, way to go. Two questions here. Zscaler. So this is a cyber name. You know, what's interesting about this is a lot of folks look at adjusted earnings, right? And a name like this, okay? So I looked at an adjusted basis. This year is trading 63 times earnings, 12 times sales. Next year, 54 times earnings, 10 times sales. But on a GAAP basis, this company is still losing a lot of money. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it, you know, you could say when people don't care about that in a raging bull market and a secular story and all that sort of stuff. But now look at this thing. It's down considerably from its high. You can talk about valuation that maybe it's cheap or expensive to its market, to its peers, but all of a sudden now on a GAAP basis, they're losing a lot of money. Thoughts on that, the GAAP versus adjusted, Danny, in general, as you think about these things, are there certain cycles where that plays better? And obviously in a downturn, it plays much worse.
Software tends to, you know, use that a lot more. Yeah. But if you're not making money on a cash basis in this economy, you haven't made money yet, necessarily. Look, CrowdStrike, I think, is probably the CRWD. Best one to kind of look at. CRWD, I think they're the best. We saw the Palo Alto, I believe, the warning and the guy down, so to speak, that stock got wrecked. I still believe in them. Obviously, we see cybersecurity threats all the time, right? Again, know what you own, to your point, buy the best one, and you buy these things. But
CrowdStrike's a great example. So on an adjusted basis, expected to grow earnings for 22%+ for the next 3 years, trades at 75 times earnings this year, 61 times next, 18 times sales this year, 14 times next. On a GAAP basis, they are profitable, far less than on an adjusted basis, but again, a really expensive stock in general. And these are some of the names that, look at that thing's rolling over. It doesn't look too different than the IGV. I know it's a component in the IGV. So I don't know. That's about it. All right. Well, listen, we covered a lot of ground here, people. We got a lot of great questions. We really appreciate that. We appreciate Danny being in the seat with Liz and myself today. Danny's going to be back with me and Carter tomorrow. We'll take more of your questions. Liz, we appreciate it as always.
Thanks
for being
me.
Here, people. A lot of fun. So check out Market Call tomorrow on the tape. It's going to be Danny, myself, and Cameron Dawson on Friday morning. That'll be the drop. And Guy will be back with Liz Monday morning, bright and early on the tape, and all week next week. So we miss Guy.
Yeah.
All right, peeps. Thanks so much. Thanks for being here.